The views expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
Live from the WGBB studios in Merrick, New York, this is Sports Talk New York.
From the crossroads of Sunrise Highway and Merrick Avenue in beautiful Merrick, Long Island, New York, this is Long Island's WGBB Sports Talk New York, 95.9 FM, 1240 AM on your dial. I'm your host, Mike Guidone, joined as always by my co-host, the man we call Cappy, Chris Caputo. 516-623-1240 is our number if you'd like to call in tonight. Again, that's 516-623-1240. Cap, good to be back. Happy New Year.
Yes, Happy New Year, and another great year of guests and fun sports shows and things to talk about.
Absolutely. We have a lot to get to tonight. We'll probably finish up with a couple of great sports stories from this past year. We have two wonderful guests tonight. We'll be joined in just a moment by Jim Gosker, who was a member of the 69 and 73 New York Mets, as well as a pretty colorful career in baseball. And later on, we'll be joined by John Patrick Higgins, who is the head basketball coach at St. John's Prep, doing a great job there. Going to fill us in a little bit on his career and what it's like coaching in a very high level in New York on the high school level. But before we get any of that, we'd like to welcome in our first guest, Mr. Jim Gosker. Jim, welcome to the program. Mike and Chris here on Long Island.
Mike, Christian, thank you for the invitation.
Oh, it's our pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us. And we know, around the holidays, there's a lot going on. You get very reminiscent of things and lots of stories. There's a great book about you. We're going to obviously cover your time in New York as a New York Met with the 69 and the 73 team. But you had a really wonderful career. Lots to talk about, great teammates. Just kind of off the top, do you still follow the game? Is there one team that you kind of look after, or is it just pretty much, you watch baseball from time to time?
Well, I've always enjoyed the Boston Red Sox because they gave me a chance to fulfill my dream and my father's dream. So I pretty much watched them or kind of, find out exactly what they're doing. Mm-hmm. But I'm close to Detroit, so I the Tigers are doing pretty well.
Yeah.
I knew the coach very well when we played ball, and I contacted him and congratulated him. The way he's handled on the players there. It's awful tough, and being a player, you look up to your manager, and they look up to A.J. Hinch, and he's getting across what he wants done, and the kids are following him, and it's worked out well there in Detroit.
Jim, you were known to be the baby as the bonus baby at the age of 19. Under the rules, you had to spend an entire season with the Boston Red Sox, not really playing too much. Can you talk about your signing and being with Boston to start?
Well, when I was, go way back, when I was 8 years old, my dad was a big baseball fan, and he had a chance to play professional baseball, but he got called in the service. So when I was born, I didn't know at the time, but he kind of took me under his wing and was in playing baseball. And he got me into Little League when I was 8 years old. And it progressed from then on and through my high school and this one short period of college that I played. He was there all the time, my dad and mom. I was very lucky. I had parents that never pushed me, but they always were there when I was playing. And my dad, he never once got upset with the way I played. He says, "We'll get him tomorrow." I mean, that was his theory. And he took me to a Tiger game when I was 8 years old, and I never forgot it. We're sitting in left field. They're playing the Boston Red Sox. My dad loved Boston, and he loved the Tigers. But he was. We were sitting there, and he said, "You see that man out in left field?" And I said, "Yeah, Dad, but I don't know who it is." He said, "It's Ted Williams." I said, "Oh, okay." He said, "Someday you're going to be out there." I said, "Dad, I'm 8 years old." He said, "Someday you're going to be out there." And I'll never forget that, you know. And when I signed the contract with the Boston Red Sox in 1962, the stories before, I was playing semi-pro ball here, and my dad always was hoping that I would sign with somebody. Well, we get a call from the Chicago Cubs. I was playing semi-pro ball here in Marysville, which is just down four miles down the road. But this man from Chicago, the Chicago Cubs, came, and very a nice gentleman. And he came in and talked to my dad, and he told him what they'd like to do. And my dad says, okay. He says, let me think about it. And when they left, I looked at Dad, and I said, Dad, that's a chance for me to play. He says, hang on. I said, okay. So about a week later, we get a call from the Cleveland Indians, and this guy comes over, and he's kind of a smart aleck, and he's telling my dad, yeah, he says, we're going to give him a chance to play. We don't think he can make the big leagues, but we're going to give him a chance to play. My dad grabbed him by the back of the neck, I'll never forget it, and ushered him to the door and said, get out of here. He said, my son can make more money working for the city here than you're offering. And when he left, I looked at Dad, I said, uh-oh, we got problems. He says, no, not really. So about a week later, we get a call from the Boston Red Sox. Maurice DeLuise from Detroit, really a nice man. I think my grandfather knew him or knew of him. And he came over, he sat down with my dad, and he said, this is what we'd like to do. We're going to give Jim a progressive bonus, or a bonus, and then we're going to offer him a progressive bonus. And my dad says, well, what does that mean? And he says, whenever he moves up either from C to B to A, every time he moves up a category, he gets a bonus. And my dad says, gee, that sounds pretty good. He says, let's make a deal. So I think I signed for $10,000, which was a lot of money back then. I'd never had money like that when I was 19 years old.
Sure. But,
then he asked Maurice DeLuise, he says, now where's Jim going to start out? He says, we're going to start him in Pocatello, Idaho. And Dad says, well, what class is that? He says, we're going to start him in Class C. And at that time, they had the rookie league, D, C, B, A, AA, and AAA.
Wow.
And Dad says, okay, you know. So we go to spring training down in Ocala, Florida, and the first time I've ever left home. And I'm calling my mom and dad every night. I'm crying. I'm afraid, you know.
Oh,
and my dad said, just relax. Have fun. I said, all right. So we start spring training. Who's my batting instructor but Ted Williams?
Wow.
And I called my dad. I said, Dad, you won't believe this. I said, I have Ted Williams as our batting instructor. He says, are you kidding? I says, no. I says, it's unbelievable. Well, near the end of spring training, Ted Williams called me aside. He says, you're not going to Pocatello, Idaho. And I said, why not? He says, because you're better than that. He says, you're going to Winston-Salem, North Carolina. And I thought, okay. So I go to Winston. I go at the end of spring training. He says, I want you to play for Eddie Papowski. He's a little manager, and he's really good. He's at Winston-Salem. So I said, okay. So we have spring training, and near the end of spring training, Pop calls me in his office, and he says, I said, Pop, what's going on? He said, Jimmy, I want you to do me a favor. I said, what's that, Pop? He said, I want you to hustle. And I looked at him. I says, well, I do hustle. He says, no. He says, I want you to hustle. I said, what do you mean, Pop? he says, after when we go into the field, I want you to race your position. When we make the, when they make the third out, I want you to race back to the dugout. And I said, okay, Pop. I says, is there a reason behind that? He says, yeah, because somebody's always watching. Mm-hmm. And I never forgot that. And that, that's how it got me to the big leagues. You know, I'm hustling. And I never forget Pop for what he's done for me.
Again, we're talking with Jim Gosker, who had a long storied career from 1963 to 1974, including playing with the Mets, and plenty of stories. There also is a book written by Brian Marshall called Goose on the Loose. You can, an ex-big leaguer recalls his colorful career. That book is on Amazon if you want to hear even more of Jim's stories.
So, Jim, I wanted to ask you, we're going to get to the Mets stuff here in just a second, but I'm always fascinated by expansion teams, and you played for the Seattle Pilots. And people, when they think of Seattle baseball, they always think Mariners. But there's one very interesting year in Seattle, which the Pilots played there as an expansion team, and then moved on and became the Milwaukee Brewers. Can you tell us a little bit what it was like to play for the expansion team there? And was it really as non-major league as it seems and appeared? I'm going to guess yes.
That stadium we played in was properly named Sick Stadium. That's exactly the way it was.
Okay.
I mean, it was like playing in a high school field.
Wow.
And the thing about it was, when we went in there that first day for opening day, we go out on the field during batting practice. They're still putting stands up in left center field.
So that is true. Okay.
It was a complete mess. And we had Joe Schultz, and I mean, there's a lot of stories about Joe Schultz, and I can reminisce about Joe Schultz, because he was a nice man, but he just did not know baseball that well. You know, his whole theory was, let's get the game over with and pound the Budweiser. He didn't care if we won or lost. I mean, and that's how bad it was there.
Yeah.
And I was there for a period of 6 weeks, and thank God I got sent to, I don't know, minor league somewhere, Nova Scotia or someplace in Canada from Seattle. But I was happy to get out of there. Then I got picked up by Saskatchewan, I think it was. And then I got picked up by the New York Mets, and I got sent to Norfolk, Virginia to Tidewater.
That
was a lot of traveling that year.
I was going to say, when that's a step up to go to Canada from Seattle and as a major leaguer, that really speaks to how poor the stadium and the scenario was, because I had heard that they were literally hammering nails in as you guys took the field.
Oh, it was terrible. I mean, it was terrible. And, the playing surface was real bad. You know, I mean, the outfield, and it was short. The fences were short. You take left center field, I think was, I don't know, maybe 325, no more than that, and it was straight across. You know, and it just was not a nice play. The people were great. The people were great because they didn't understand the game. You know, I mean, they were cheering for fly ball. You know, but Schultz, you know, a nice man. He just didn't really care about winning or losing, mm-hmm. as long as the Budweiser was in the cooler. And I mean, the stories that Boughton, we didn't know Boughton was writing a book when we were out there, but everything he put in that book is true. I got a copy of the book, and I laughed, you know, at the stuff that he had talked about. And it was different. I mean, I was glad to get out of there, and I was happy. The only bad thing is I had my family with me. I had to drive all the way back, drive them home to Michigan here, and then fly to Virginia to play ball there.
So, Jim, you eventually make it up to the big leagues in New York with the Mets. You're on a team with guys like Jerry Grody and Tommy Agee, Ron Swoboda, even have Nolan Ryan on this team. Which guys did you kind of click with, even if you were just a utility guy, you know, playing the outfield here and there?
Well, I liked Tom Seaver was one of my best friends. I mean, and he was the best pitcher that I ever played with. He was that good, and he was consistent. But we had a good team there. You know, we weren't very powerful as far as power hitting. We had a lot of line drive hitters, but we had good pitching. And pitching at that time was the name of the game. I mean, you got Matlock, you got Seaver, you got Kuzman, and Tug McGraw coming in a relief. And if we got three runs, we got a good chance to win with McGraw coming in. I mean, they were that good. And I enjoyed it up there. The time I was there that I got up there in 69, I got called from Triple A ball, and I get up there, and Gil Hodges, really a nice man and really good at baseball. I mean, he knew the game. And he called me in the office, and he said, "Jimmy, welcome aboard." He says, "I'm going to use you whenever I can." But he says, "Basically, if we're ahead in the seventh inning, you're going to be in the outfield." He says, "Because I want your defense." And he says, I'll move AJ or somebody out of there, and you're going to be out there. And I said, "Gil, whatever you want to do is fine." Well, after the year was over with, they win the National League Championship, so they're going to the World Series. And Gil calls me in the office. He said, "Jim, I need an extra pitcher." He says, "I'm going to have to take you off the Major League roster." And I said, "Gil, that's fine." I said, "This has been the most exciting experience that I've had." I said, "I'm here for 4 or 5 weeks. I said, I helped win a couple of games defensively. And I said, it was a thrill. And I figured after the year, you know, I was hoping, well, maybe I'll get a World Series ring. But now, but they did send me, when they win the World Series, they send me a check for $100.
Oh, huge.
And I looked at the check, and I told my wife, I said, "This is nuts." So I signed a check, sent it back to Ed Cranepool, who was the player representative. I said, "Buy yourself a case of beer and keep the change."
Such a great story.
I got a lot of people were calling me and saying, "Why didn't you get the ring?" And I said, "I don't know." And then 40 years later, when they have the reunion, they declared me dead.
Yeah, so they had your name up on the scoreboard as dead.
Yeah, got a phone. The scoreboard that I've had. And thank you for your help, and we wish you could have been here. It was funny because about a week before the reunion, I got a call from a friend of mine up in New York. He says, "You coming up to the reunion?" I says, "I have never got any invitation."
Right.
And afterwards, I find out the reason I didn't get an invitation because they thought I was dead.
Well, yeah, you and I believe Jesse Hudson were both listed up there as no longer alive. But then you got the phone call. You know, I thought,
"Oh my God, this guy called me," and he says, "I still believe that he was drunk when he called me because he says, 'I'm going to apologize for it.'" And I just said, "F off," and hung up.
I thought maybe at that point they'd send you a ring, but I guess you still haven't gotten one.
No. I got the one in 74, and that's never left my hand.
Yep.
I got the one in the 74, but I got a replica of the 69 ring. These friends of mine were season ticket holders up there, and they're on my Facebook. And Joe Ahern, I come home one night, my wife was there, she says, "You got a package here," and I ripped it open, and it was the World Series ring, and I thought.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I called Joe Ahern and I said, "Did you guys buy this ring for me?"
Yeah.
And he says, "No, Jim, it's a duplicate."
Yeah.
He says, it's just a stone. I find out, I don't know if you remember, what the heck was his name, the young pitcher that got killed. He was one of our pitchers there. He got killed.
Corey Lytle?
an automobile, or in a car, not a car accident, but in a motorcycle accident or something. Anyway, his wife had contacted one of the players and asked him if they could get, see how much they could get for that 69 ring. And I think she, who she said, Art Shamsie, I think, was the one that helped her. And they offered the ring, and do you know how much they got for that ring?
No.
A 69 ring, over $200,000.
Wow.
Okay.
And I thought, wow. That's and crazy. I come to find out here, about 2 weeks ago, these people are always contacting me saying, did you get your ring yet? And I said, no. Well, supposedly, this one guy had found out this people that are making the rings, whoever it was. And I think you can get the ring now for like $24,000.
Wow. Okay.
And I said, I had contacted the ball club the year after. I said, I'd like to buy the ring. And they said at the time it was, I don't know, $15,000 or $20,000. I says, I don't have that kind of money. Never mind.
Well, after everything that has gone on and the mistake that they made, I think that you should have your pick of as many rings as you would like, because that I can only imagine having to make that call. And I have no sympathy for the Mets and the poor guy, well, who had to call you. But I wanted to ask you something. You know, you had mentioned in 69 playing for Gil Hodges, just an absolute legend, you know, as a manager and player here in the New York area. And then in 73, you're playing for Yogi Berra. And what was it like playing for Yogi in those days? And okay.
Yeah. I'll tell you what, Yogi was a great guy. Uh-huh. But yeah. Yogi made some moves that just would blow your mind. And I remember before one game, we have this meeting, and he says, he's rattling on, and I'm sitting between, I think, Tommy Agee and Cleon Jones. And I'm the Oriole cookie between them. And then we're sitting there, and Yogi's carrying on, and pretty soon, he finishes up, he said, remember, fellas, you're never out of it until you're out of it. And Cleon Jones looks at me, he says, Goose, what'd he say? I guess we're never out of it until we're out of it. But Yogi was a great guy, but he just didn't make the moves that normally a manager would make. Mm-hmm. And one example was that we've had Rusty Staub was pinch hitting or went up the bat and he pinch hit for somebody. Then he put Don Hahn out in the outfield. And then after that, he wanted me to go out in the outfield, or he had Hahn run. That's what it was. And then he wanted me to go out in the outfield. I said, why are we using three people for one job? You know, Hahn was a good outfielder.
Yeah.
But he changed. That's the way Yogi was. I mean, nice guy, really a nice person. But boy, he had some crazy things that he did, and you know, you reminisce and think about it. But and personally, he was a really nice man. He was funny. He was a funny guy.
We're talking with Jim Gosker, who played with the 1969 and 1973 Mets. His book, written by Brian Marshall, is called Goose on the Loose. You can get it on Amazon. Jim also donates some of his proceeds back to the St. Jude's Children's Hospital, which I think is
every
great.
Every bit of it.
Yep.
Every bit of it.
Oh, that's fantastic.
I think that's great. Jim, you were the last batter to face Satchel Paige when he was really up there in his 50s. Can you explain what that situation was like?
Yep. We go in, I'm with the Red Sox, we go into Kansas City, and we're taking batting practice, and you look down the right field line, and there's somebody sitting in a rocking chair, and there's a nurse down there, and we didn't know what was going on. Well, after batting practice, our secretary comes in and says they're having a promotion. And Finley was big on promotions.
Yeah.
And they said, we've got this Satchel Paige, who's 58 years old. He's going to be throwing the first three innings. and everybody's cracking up. 58 years old, they got this guy. Come to find out, he pitched three innings against us. We get one hit.
Wow.
One hit. Carl Yastrzemski got the only hit. The great thing about it was, I can't imagine how hard he threw when he was younger, because he was clocked, probably pitching against us in the 80s, and he's 58 years old.
Man.
But everything was belt high or below. He never got above the belt. And I remember I grounded out the first time, and then the second time I grounded out, I was the third out of the inning. I was running to grab my glove, and he grabbed my arm, and it scared the living hell out of me. And he looked at me, and he said, "Good luck, young man." Oh. And I never forgot that.
Wow.
I said, "Wow, what a tribute from a man of his age to say something like that to a young kid like me."
Absolutely. And throughout your career, you know, we talk Boston, you played for the A's when they were in Kansas City, then in Oakland. Would you ever in your wildest dreams imagine a professional baseball team, take away the A's, being located in Las Vegas like they're going to be soon?
Well, I guess these clubs go. Now, when we moved from Kansas City to Oakland, that was terrible.
Mm-hmm.
Because we didn't draw in Oakland at all.
Right.
I could never figure out why we moved from Kansas City. Was a great place.
It's one of the best baseball towns around.
Absolutely love that place. And we had the best field man that you could ever see, the George Toma. Our field there was like a pool table, for gosh sakes. It was absolutely beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And when we moved to Oakland, it's completely different. Big stadium. You hit a pop-up foul ball, and you got from first base to the dugout, you got probably a good 20, 25 yards.
Yeah.
That's how big it was. And, you know, you hit a pop-up, and then you're out. You know, you can't get a foul ball. And it was so cold out there.
Hmm.
I mean, at nighttime, you had to wear a long-sleeve shirt because of the weather.
Yeah.
I mean, it just the wind would come right off the mountain out there. It just was not a good place to play. I mean, as far as that and Six Stadium, they're the two worst I ever played in.
So with those being the two worst, am I guessing that Fenway was your favorite?
Yeah, Fenway, and I also enjoyed playing in over there with the Cubs. Well, the Cubs, and the older field. Park,
okay.
With the Cubs.
Yeah.
Favorite
Cubs.
Favorite coach or manager?
My coach or manager, the best manager I ever played for was Alvin Dark.
Really?
No question.
Hmm.
And the reason why, I'll tell you this, when I joined that club, I went from Boston to Kansas City. I was hitting Kansas City pretty good, so evidently Boston, they traded me over to Kansas City. Alvin Dark was the manager. And when I went in the office, he said, "Welcome aboard, Jimmy." He says, "Here's what I'm going to do." He says, "You're going to play against left or right-handers. Joe Nosek will play against left-handers." I said, "Skip, whatever you want to do is fine with me." But the thing that I enjoyed about him, he treated me like I was his son, and his daughter is on my Facebook. We talk all the time, Laura Nail, and she always tells me, she says, "My dad thought you were the greatest." And I said, "Well, I was pretty excited to play for him." The thing about it, Alvin Dark, was that he knew baseball so well. But, when I wasn't playing, he would walk down to me and he'd say, "Hey, Jimmy, what do you think we ought to do in this situation?" And I said, "Skip, you're the manager." He says, "I just want your input."
Wow.
I mean, and Laura told me, his daughter told me, she says, "He thought the world of you."
Hmm.
"He always talked about you." And I says, "Well, I'll tell you what, Laura," I said, "he was like a second father to me." You know, he took me under his wing. He talked to me all the time. And the good thing about Alvin was that he treated all the players like that. I mean, he was just a great person and a smart baseball man. Boy, he was smart. And I, he's the best I ever played for, no question.
Well, contrary to some Mets belief on a 40th anniversary, Jim Gosger is still alive, and he's telling great stories. If you want to read the book by Brian Marshall, it's called Goose on the Loose on Amazon. He lives in the same hometown, actually in the same house that his parents grew up in.
Yep, and he's still here.
And he gave us a great interview here, so we appreciate time tonight, Jim.
Thank you so much. And this is the God's honest truth, Jim. While we were talking, I ordered the book because I think we could go another hour with.
I've still got copies. I've got about 25 copies left. I purchased. I spent my own money and purchased 200 copies.
Wow.
And I've got rid of 170 of them.
Okay.
And all the money, every single penny goes to St. Jude.
Well, that's not surprising because you sound like a truly amazing guy. That is an amazing gesture. Thank you so much for joining us. We'd love to have you on again to talk a little bit deeper if we could. And
please, fellas, keep in touch.
Oh, absolutely. You know? It's been our honor and our pleasure. And you just keep punching out there, and we can't wait to have you on again.
Great. Thanks very much, guys.
Absolutely.
You guys have a great evening.
Thank you so much. Jim Goose Gosker, what a great interview, Cap, and what just a great guy.
Still going hard at 83.
And we could do another hour with him easy.
Yeah.
All right, we'll be back in just a minute with the second half hour of Sports Talk New York.
Listening to Sports Talk New York. Tune in every Sunday night at 8 p.m. on Long Island's WGBB. Broadcasting on 95.9 FM and 1240 AM. Or listen live online at WGBBRadio.com. Stay connected to Sports Talk New York on WGBB by following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at WGBB Sports Talk. You're listening to Sports Talk New York on Long Island's WGBB. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to the second half of Sports Talk New York here on WGBB 95.9 FM, 1240 AM. The number to call in is 516-623-1240 if you'd like to join us a little later or have a question for our next guest. Well, Cappy and I were just talking a little bit about something with Jim Gosker that we'll get to at the end. We kind of have a New Year's resolution already for him, but
let's go.
Very happy to be joined by John Patrick Higgins, who is the head boys basketball or men's basketball coach, we'll call it that, at St. John's Prep High School here in New York. And coach, welcome to the program.
Appreciate you guys having me. Looking forward to a great conversation and talking a lot about hoops.
Absolutely. So we last year, or about 16 months ago, we had on your younger brother, who was a member of the team at Bryant University, and had a very colorful kind of career as a basketball player. And truth be told, I was speaking to your dad, and he said, you had a good Higgins on, but you got to get the better one on here for an interview. And that's why, and I think you'll agree, we're ready to hear all about your coaching, your background, and on a serious note, congratulations, you just won your 100th game there. If I have this correct, I think in the last 2 weeks, you won your 100th game, you celebrated your birthday, mm-hmm. and you got married.
Yeah.
That's a hat trick right there, my man.
All in the past couple weeks, and funny enough, we had the wedding on Friday night, and then home game Sunday. so no rest for the weary, just straight turnaround and right back to it.
Well, yeah, I was going to say your wife certainly knows what she's getting herself into as a coach's wife, but that's fantastic stuff.
100%.
Yeah, well, seriously, congratulations and welcome to the world of marriage, and I'm sure you'll do just great as you are as a basketball coach. If you could tell us a little bit, I know you started out, you went to St. Mary's and got to know Coach Tim Kluse, and then went on to Iona. Just give us a little background on how you started in your coaching and what your thoughts were about basketball and if you really wanted to become a coach.
Yeah, I mean, I was fortunate enough to be around basketball my entire life. My mom played Division I at Fairfield University. My grandfather was coaching with Manhasset High School girls varsity, and would drag me around to the practices and all the games, and I'd sit at the end of the bench and was just kind of immersed in it from a very young age, with, you know, my dad also running CYO at St. Mary's and coaching me throughout my early years. So, you know, I've been blessed and fortunate enough to be around great people. And mm-hmm. you know, when we talk about, you know, post high school at St. Mary's and you know, going to Iona, you know, being able to kind of be a student manager under Tim Kloos was probably one of the most beneficial things for me, you know, looking back now of my coaching journey, right? You know, you're talking about one of the all-time great basketball minds, in my opinion, winner everywhere he went. And, you know, just seeing how he ran the program, seeing how he ran practice, seeing how he got kids to buy in, you know, new guys every year to buy in and kind of cultivate, you know, that winning program where, you know, for the 4 years I was there, we went to the NCAA tournament twice and to the NIT twice, mm-hmm. you know. So, you know, not many people are fortunate enough to be around that type of success, and not enough, you know, I don't feel like, you know, not many people are fortunate enough to be around, you know, a program that has won that often and that many times and has that winning culture. So for me, I was able to take everything, you know, that I learned there and kind of apply it to, you know, what we're doing now in our program, and you know, it's been working out for the past couple of years for us, you know, for sure.
So when you started at St. John's Prep, can you talk a little bit about, you know, the team or the program that you inherited and what your thoughts were in terms of building the program and kind of the image that you wanted?
Yeah, so, I mean, it's funny how small the world is when you talk about sport. You know, it doesn't have to be basketball. It could be any sport, really. You know, I was coaching, you know, 5th and 7th grade Long Island Lightning team with my dad, and we happened to play Bill Matiratana, you know, who was a Long Island coaching legend in his own right. Mm-hmm. You know, teams with Tobias Harris and Tavon Fledge and all those guys. And,
sure.
You know, at Island Garden one night, he said, hey, you know, I don't know if you're looking to potentially coach in high school, but I have a former student athlete who's at St. John's Prep and he's a JV coach. I said, yeah, I'll take the number. I'll call him right when I walk out of the gym. So I called, you know, had the interview up at the school. You know, for me, I couldn't tell you where St. John's Prep was on the map prior to working there.
Right.
You know, being a Long Island guy and not necessarily getting into Queens too much. And, you know, by the time I got there and had the conversation, you know, they brought me in as varsity assistant. You know, we won two games that year, and, you know, it was a program rich in history. Mm-hmm. When you look back, I mean, you have Coach Gatto, you have, you know, Talik Brown, who's assistant coach at St. John's University now, who was a McDonald's All-American who went to UConn. Even going back to the Moder Christi days, you know, the program was rich in history and kind of, you know, I'd say it wasn't necessarily, you know, within those winning ways when I was getting there, right? And, you know, the first year was a struggle as assistant coach, and, you know, the main goal of it was just to get the kids better. You know, that's the goal every single year. If you can take a kid and get them better, not only on the court but off the court, then you're succeeding in terms of what you need to do as a coach. So,
sure.
You know, we were able to do that our first year a little bit in terms of just getting kids to buy into what we wanted to do. And, you know, the following year, the head coach ended up leaving right before the season started. So, you know, I was elevated as head coach. And, you know, at the time, I think I still am, but I definitely was at this time the youngest head coach in all of New York City Catholic High School. I was 23 when I was named head coach. You know, and we went from winning two games to eight games right away, you know, with the same team that we had. So, you know, seeing that type of success, kids wanted to, you know, feel more of it and buy in a little bit more. And, you know, we didn't go out and play any cupcakes. I mean, we played Blue High and all those teams,
sure.
You know, each year. And, you know, we were going out and challenging ourselves every which way. And it got to the point where we kind of built it to, you know, a place that nobody probably might have heard of before. You know, and sometimes you talk to some of the kids as they're looking for prospective high schools, and you tell them about where you are, and, you know, they'll look at you like, I don't even know where that place is.
Yeah.
But now it's almost like a place where, you know, we have a lot of kids that are coming in for open houses and tours that are really interested in the program and wanting to be a part of something special. So, you know, doing everything the way that we do in terms of the right way, you know, some of the people can get lost in terms of, you know, misleading, misguiding, things like that, but really just getting the kids to buy in and having them do it the right way, you know, it leads to and has led for us to be successful at the level that we're at.
Again, we're talking with John Patrick Kiggins from St. John's Prep. John, can you explain a little bit about New York City basketball for those that don't know? There's like an A level and a double A level and what type of schools you play. And then eventually when it comes time for playoffs, where do you guys fit in and what you have to do on a yearly basis?
Absolutely. Yeah, no, I mean, it's so funny. So, you know, back in the day, you know, when I first was starting, you know, I put a big emphasis on social media and marketing in that sense, where we were having photographers and videographers, right? And, you know, people were coming up to me like, wow, you really have a really good team, like one of the best in the state. I mean, little did they know we were playing the B division at the time. You know what I mean? So when you take a look at the way that the Catholic League works, they have the B level, the A level, which we're currently in, and then the double A. You know, the A level right now is us. You know, if you go to Staten Island, Moore Catholic, St. Joe by the Sea, Farrell. You go to Brooklyn, it's St. Edmunds. You go to the Bronx, it's Fordham Prep, New Rochelle, Salesian, Xavier in Manhattan, McClancy as well. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's a lot of those schools where then you get to the double A, it's your Molloy, St. Francis Prep, Holy Cross, Christ the King, Stepanak, Iona Prep, so on and so forth. So,
right.
You know, when we get into playoff time, you know, we'll play our Division A, and then when you're in the A conference or A class, you're in the same class as the Long Island Catholics, as well as the Buffalo Catholic schools as well. So we all compete for a state championship at the end of the year, whereas the double A, their state championship is whoever wins the city.
So you went from winning you know, two games to eight, well, then your then eight games as your first year as head coach, and then to a state championship. I mean, that is on anybody's resume, that's an impressive thing. Take away the, you know, obviously the talent, which you have to be a team that good to win it. You know, you talked about your social media and branding the school and different things. Talk a little bit about what you do just from a team building sense, to get a program from an 8-win to a state championship to where it kind of talks about itself. Is there anything, you know, you're able to do, if I'm correct, you're a dean of students in the school. Is there anything you're able to do with these guys just kind of outside of school or throughout your school day, even outside of basketball, that helps with that kind of, you know, goal to get to?
Yeah, it's a great point because, you know, for us, we've been blessed and fortunate to have a lot of kids that transferred into the school, right, from, you know, public school. You know, like, for example, this year we have a kid who moved with his family because his dad's a UN diplomat from Cyprus and moved to, you know, Astoria and has come to the school. So it's a lot of blending of cultures, really, this year, too. But, you know, you can't – it's funny. Like, people say, oh, you know, the guys look really connected, right? And, you know, you can't basically force people to hang out with each other,
right.
You know?
Yeah.
But at the same time, you know, a lot of the kids that come all kind of fit the same type of social profile, right?
Mm-hmm.
Really great kids, caring, leaders, you know, they're great leaders throughout the building, you know, kids that, you know, won't give anybody a hard time, you know, practice in the classroom, whatever the case is. So I've been blessed and fortunate enough to kind of have kids come in that have fit that profile. And, you know, the coaching staff I have is phenomenal, and they know the type of kids that we want to have our program embody, and we do a great job of getting it. I mean, For the most part, you know, the season is November to March, you know, when you take a look at basketball. But these guys are in the weight room preseason, postseason, you know, getting shots up, you know, open gym settings and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So as much as basketball in that sense is that four-month gap and that four-month season, a lot of these guys are spending time with each other outside of the season,
sure.
Making it, you know, really just our season being 11 months, you know, when it comes down to it with the kind of leadership that our kids have that are holding these, you know, open gyms and getting guys to different gyms and having them work out and stuff like that. So, you know, for us, we're blessed and fortunate that we've had that kind of continuity with our unit.
Absolutely.
Coach, you talked about the travel circuit and doing some stuff for the Long Island Lightning. I did that back in the day. You have, as you said, a lot of social media that you do. You got some players in Daquan Bryan and Richard Jefferson Fernandez, like guys that I see you're trying to post things about them. How hard is it in this day and age to get these guys to the next level, to find them a place to play at the college level as you're trying to put their stuff out there?
Yeah. let me tell you, I was having this conversation earlier today with somebody, and you know, I don't want to say I'm an expert by any means, but you know, I feel pretty well versed in the world of college recruiting. You know what I mean? And how guys can get to the next level. And sometimes I sit here still and scratch my head because, you know, here's an example. We had a kid last year who was a three-time all-league player, 1,000-point scorer, MVP of our team, city champion, right? All that stuff. And, you know, colleges were like, I don't know if we're interested. You know, so what are we really trying to look at? What are we waiting for? And I think that the mold, unfortunately, that college is kind of finding itself in is everyone's waiting for
the transfer
the next
portal
best thing to drop. Yeah. Exactly. So if you take a look at a Division I level, you have all these guys that, you know, now it's getting even crazier with these overseas guys and these G League guys that people are recruiting. But you have all these guys that are working within the portal. Then you have a lot of the D2 teams that, you know, they're getting their high academics and stuff like that, but they're also waiting for guys from D1 to drop down, potentially. Then you get guys potentially at the D3 level that are waiting for these D2, D1 guys to drop down to them, right? And at some point, what are we doing with the high school kids?
They suffer.
And that's not just our program. It's every program.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it at some point, you know, there has to be some sort of way that the NCAA is just going to make, you know, stop the nonsense. This is what we're looking at and going from there, right? Because otherwise you're going to have every single kid that does the 4 years of high school, then will have to do a prep year if they want to play at any level in terms of college basketball, unless you're at the top 100 or something like that. You know, and then what are we really doing in terms of trying to grow the game and put these kids in the best position possible, right? Because that's what we're trying to do at the end of the day. It's not only at our level, but it's at every level, right? Is that you're trying to do what you would think is the best thing for the kid and the athlete.
Yeah, and it's
so,
really,
you know,
It's just really hard in this day and age where people are looking for a couple extra bucks to go somewhere else. And also, you know, the high school kid is just playing the waiting game because the transfer portal opens up in March and these kids are still, you know, looking for a school.
100%. But, you know, we've been fortunate. You know, 2 years ago we had a kid that went to St. Joe's Brooklyn. You know, he played a lot his freshman year. Was a high impact player, which was good. We had a kid last year who ended up going to Damon College, or now Damon University.
Mm-hmm.
They're number, I think, top five team in the country for Division II. So we've had these kids from our program going to the next level, which is good. And you know, it's not going to change. Daquan's going to go on somewhere next year and be a great player. You know, the kid Nikhil Najee on our team, he's going to go on to the next level and be great somewhere. So you know, we have these kids and, you know, we have a new senior as well, Miles Perry. He's going to go on somewhere, a big 6'6", 6'7", athletic kid who, you know, is kind of a force in the paint and does a lot of great stuff. So, you know, for us, we'll still do our due diligence and making sure that we're putting our kids in the best position to be successful, you know, post-high school.
Sure. Again, we're talking to John Patrick Higgins, head coach at St. John's Prep in Astoria, Queens. And one of the other things I just would mention to you, John, and I'm sure you're aware of this, you know, 25, 30 years ago when I first started coaching in my 20s on the college level, I was at New York Tech, Division II school, no sports anymore. Southampton College, closed.
Dowling
College, closed. These maybe I'm the curse, but I'll tell you, it's so hard. It's got to be just so hard. Like you said, you have these kids who have these fantastic resumes. There's just not a lot of spots. And you know, you mentioned some great things about waiting and trying to find your spot, and you know, take away Division I. But you know, I don't think people understand, and you did a really great job of explaining what you do as a high school coach. You know, not only for, you know, the kids who like to play ball, and this might be their last time that they're playing, but the ones who really do want to go on, their choices are just so limited.
Yeah, I mean, listen, it's funny. You know, beginning of the year, you always ask kids, raise your hand if you want to play at the next level, you know, and whether they mean it or whether they just are trying to raise their hand to make sure that I'm not like, well, why are you here? You know what I mean? Not like I would do that, but
yeah,
you know,
no, I understand. Yeah, absolutely.
And then you get, and then you get on through the year and you're like, you know, for those that raise their hand, what are you doing to prepare yourself? Cause there's only so much you can do in terms of practice time. You know what I mean? Like practice time is limited. You get an hour and a half, 2 hours, whatever the case is. You have to share gym with the other teams. What are you doing on your own? Are you in the weight room extra hours? Are you going and find a place to get shots up? Are you running those extra sprints, right? Are you doing the things that will help you you know, and your game. You know, there's nothing wrong with being a great high school player. You know what I mean? There's a lot of people who were great high school players, did a lot of great things, and you have those memories and you're kind of remembered in the history books. You know, but for those that are truly wanting to do it, you know, we always tell them that college is a much different ballgame. Mm-hmm. It's almost like a job. You're walking into a job, especially if you're getting scholarship and potential NIL if you're that good.
Yeah.
You're walking into a job now. You know what I mean? Like somebody is spending money on you to help that university, you know, be great.
Absolutely.
You know, and that's the thing, too. A lot of people don't realize that. A lot of these college coach jobs are relying on these 18 to 22-year-old kids.
Amen.
And if they're not, you know, if they were sold a false bag of goods on works hard, is prepared, does all that stuff, you know, people lose their jobs over that. So, you know, a lot of times, too, coaches aren't, you know, coming in, looking at a kid saying, perfect, we want them. You know, a lot of the times, the first question I get about any kid, how are the academics? Which is a great question.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, they're student-athletes. You know, and they want to make sure that they're going to be academically eligible. So, you know, it's a lot of due diligence. It's not easy by
of
any
course.
Stretch, but, you know, it's getting more and more difficult, I feel like, for some of these high school players to go on to that next level right away.
Right, and the parents and the players need to understand that when a college coach is coming to talk to you, you're going to tell them the straight scoop, because if you don't, like you said, you're selling, they're not going to come back to you and recruit any of your team, or you lose all credibility because it's not worth it for one kid to go and then it's all over.
Exactly. I mean, we tell the kids constantly it's bigger than you in the sense where everything that's done is for the program. Because at the end of the day, you know, a kid's high school career is 4 years. You know, but us coaches, we plan on being here for the long haul.
Oh,
we
yeah.
plan on all these things for years down the line. And, you know, what you think might help you now in trying to get a short-term gain by something happening and maybe, you know, not being completely honest with that coach hurts you in the long run when all of a sudden you might need that said coach to come down and recruit one of your guys. You know, they're not going to do that if... You know, they come in and say, you know, I remember a couple of years ago,
sure.
you know, we weren't told the honest truth. You know
undoubtedly.
What I mean? It kind of kills your program.
Most definitely.
John, last one from me. The coaching carousel, you went to St. Mary's, and now you're at a Catholic school yourself. You played under Tim Kloos. You know, I played for Mike, who's my co-host here, but I also played in CYO for Bill O'Keefe, who was an assistant at Iona as well.
Bill O'Keefe, absolutely.
What is there a reason why some of these guys, a little bit about their philosophy that you take with you as you know, get your own gig?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, for me, prior to, you know, just the great brotherhood that Iona, you know, kind of forged for us and for me in particular, you know, being around the guys, you know, I was fortunate to kind of have a relationship with the guys and the coaches. You know what I mean? Sometimes it's a little difficult when you're standing on either side, you know, you don't want to come off pro one, pro the other, but, you know, I was fortunate enough to kind of have a relationship with everybody and maintain those relationships till this day. You know, when, you know, we put a team in and I put a team and created a team for TBT, you know, the million-dollar take-all tournament in the summer, we did an Iona team for 3 years. You know, the school and the administration was all on board helping out any way they could. You know, we were able to get a lot of the guys to come back and play for the team. And a lot of the stuff that we were doing was the same stuff we did at the collegiate level, you know. And a lot of the stuff that we do today in terms of our practices, in terms of how we view situations and defensive schemes and offensive schemes is a lot of the stuff that I learned at that college level.
Mm.
You know, and the other things too, you know, I'm constantly watching, you know, college basketball every night, you know, and I've watched a couple games where we've implemented new baseline out of bounds sets from things that I saw and I really liked, you know, and it's worked for us. So, you know, you never know where you'll get your inspiration from. You know, you could even go to a CYO game and see something that you like and try to draw it up and go from there. So, you know, in the world of coaching, you're always learning.
Absolutely.
You know, and I think that for me, I was blessed and fortunate enough to have, you know, one of the better teachers, you know, when you're talking about learning the game of basketball, and Coach Kloos and everybody on that staff.
Absolutely. Coach Kloos, you know, I got to know him many years ago when I was at New York Tech. When he was at St. Mary's, he would come and watch. I was a men's assistant coach for Frank Morris, who was a legend. And Coach Kloos would come and take notes. And, you know, you just are a student of the game, and you certainly have your head in the right spot. Before we let you go, you're 13-1 this year, if I have that correct?
Yep.
What's your next game, and what do you look for league-wise? What's the team to beat other than yourself?
Yeah, so right now we're 13-1. We're 8-0 in the league. You know, we're having a pretty good year. We have a big, we have two really big home games, league games coming up. We have one this Friday against Xavier. You know, we pulled one out at the end against them at their place. So, you know, they're really tough. And then the following week we're playing McClancy, and that's a big rivalry game. Last year we had about 1,600 people in the stands. Mm. It was broadcasted on Varsity Media. It was a great, great event. It was a great night. But when you take a look at our league, anybody can beat anybody on every given night. And I was telling the kids this because, you know, we played a really tough Farrell team the other day at the Power Memorial, and, you know, their record isn't indicative of how good they are, I would say. And,
sure.
You know, we were down 12 at half and found a way to come back and win at the end and got stops and did what we needed to do. But, you know, that's the beauty about our league. You know, some people say if you're not in Double-A, you're not having good basketball. To me, it's the complete opposite. You know, at our level, there's a game night in and night out that if you are not on your game, you're going to find a way to lose that game. So, you know, every game is tough, and, you know, we've been fortunate enough we haven't lost at home in 2 years, so anytime that we're able to play at home, it's a little bit of an advantage that we have. So, you know, lucky for us, we have a lot of our remaining league games at home, but, you know, it's one of those leagues that, to me, it's one of the best leagues in the country, and, you know, we compete night in and night out, and if you don't bring your game, you know, you're getting back on that van, that bus, however you got to that game, you know, scratching your head saying, what do we got to do to be better? So,
absolutely.
You know, Friday should be a good one. We're excited. 7:30, going to be home. We're honoring Moder Christi, so it should be a packed house. We're in alternate and special uniforms for the night. So
right.
it should be a great night in Astoria.
Well, Coach John Patrick Higgins, that's a name you basketball folks keep an eye on. He's rising up the ranks and certainly somebody to keep an eye on throughout. Congratulations on your success so far. All the best, you know, moving forward, and we really thank you for joining us tonight, and hope to have you on again, you know, come playoff time.
Absolutely. Mike, Chris, thank you so much, and appreciate it, and as always, go Red Storm.
You got it. Absolutely. Coach John Patrick Higgins from St. John's Prep. Really, you know, first of all, great interview, a lot of interesting stuff. I think you asked a great question about how difficult it is to sell, I hate to use the word sell, but, you know, sell kids to the college level.
We might have to do a half hour in the next coming weeks on the high school kid and where they fit in the college ranks, because everything's changing.
Absolutely.
And there's just no spot for them. And, you know, I listen to Calipari with, you got 5 years to play, you're four, and that's it. And, you know, I just think it's just becoming too much right now that guys are playing for too long. And that's going to be a show, I think, that we'd have to get some guests on to talk about.
And just on a general point, just the small number of schools there are now.
Yeah.
I mean, I rattled off three, and there's two more that I could.
Not much left.
Yeah, and it's just getting tough out there. But, you know, with coaches like John Patrick, you know, we're in good shape with the game. And thank you to Jim Gossner, the Goose, who gave us some good stuff. Well, I'm sure we'll talk to him again. Cap, Happy New Year. Great job.
Yeah.
All right.
Enjoy the football playoffs coming up.
All right. And root for my Falcons to get a little healthier and get moving here in the new year. Brian Graves behind the glass. Again, once again, great job. Everyone, we'll see you in a couple of weeks, and Happy New Year.
The views expressed in the previous program did not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.